Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Hello and welcome to Caged In Presents Coppola Connections, as ever brought to you by the Breadcrumbs Collective and hosted by me, Petros Patsilivas. For those of you who are uninitiated at what we do here, we watch every single film in the collective Coppola family filmography to determine, are they the greatest film family of all time? I do not do that alone, however. I'm joined by a lovely guest each week and get their input. To find out on this film alone, are they the greatest film family of all time? And the film we will be discussing this week, which we'll get into in a bit more detail just after this brief intro, is The House Bunny from 2008. And I will be joined by Dave Corkery from the Fantastic Cinemile podcast. So yeah, stick around for that. As ever, we will be discussing this film in all of the scantily clad details. We will be pulling out that centerfold of this film and getting right into it. So if you haven't seen this film, go out and watch it. Don't go out and watch it. It's still a fun listen. Anyway, we get into a lot of fun stuff, whether it is what this film could have been, perhaps, with the pedigree of the writers. We even talk about the initial script plans for this and Anna Faris as a kind of entity. Yeah, we go all over the place. So I guess that all that's left to do is to get yourself over to your local sorority house, become a house mother, get kicked out of the Playboy mansion, and get into some hijinks, whether it's getting sexy, smartening up. But one thing that we must do whilst we're here is make some Coppola connections. So this week, unfortunately, we've been kicked out of the Playboy Mansion to discuss the 2008 Happy Madison College comedy, The House Bunny, directed by Happy Madison regular Fred Wolf, written by Kirsten Smith and Karen McCullough Lutz, and starring Anna Faris, Emma Stone, Colin Hanks, Kat Dennings, Rumor Williams, and boast cameos from a plethora of Adam Sandler's pals. Playboy bunnies, and renowned sleazebag Hugh Hefner. Today's Coppola connection, a very tangential one for this film, a very minor role, is Matthew Shire, who worked on the film as a production assistant. So joining me today to decide if the Coppola family are the cinematic centerfold material or just the flavor of the week is one half of the award-winning Cinemile podcast, Dave Corkery. How are you, Dave?
I'm great. Thank you for having me. I'm sorry the other half, the better half, couldn't be here.
No,
But she had a prior arrangement and also refused to watch the second half of this movie. She got halfway.
Yeah, we'll get to it. I already a little insight for the listeners. I already know Dave's thoughts on this film. I feel like I'm, and I'm going to say it up front, I think I'm slightly warmer on this film, and maybe, I don't know.
Great. I'll provide a counterpoint to that.
Yeah, I tried to be nice. I found it so...
I mean, I'm the one who chose it, so it's all on me.
The onus is very much on you, Dave. I'm gonna let it weigh heavy on your shoulders. It was really tempted to say your name as well in the Anna Faris voice throughout this film every time she says someone's name. So Dave.
That's a good running gag. I will give there's a few really good gags in this movie, and that is one of them.
Yeah, there is some stuff as well that is aged like milk, like regards to the time this film came out. But we'll get
is that yeah okay yeah we'll save it.
We'll get to all of that. But before we do, tell us a little bit about the cinema. I'm sure many people have listened to it before and are aware of what you guys do. But just in case people aren't, What is it? What is it you do? Just so we can get to know you a bit, Dave.
Well, what do we do? It's a very simple premise, really. It's myself and my wife, Kathy, just record our walks home from the movies. So we go to the cinema, we watch a movie, and then on the way home, we switch on a recorder and we get our very instant reactions to that, along with, you know, all the usual... traffic stops and people occasionally deciding to yell into the microphone and dogs barking and all the sorts of chaos that that happen. And yeah, we know we've been doing it for 6 years now, and you know, we've been very fortunate to win a few awards and get some nice press, and we've just we absolutely love doing it. And the other great thing is we've gotten just love being in the podcast scene, and we've got to meet some great people like yourself and many others. We've got a lovely little community going, so the podcast film crew. So, absolutely a lovely little corner that we all need to snuggle into as Twitter collapses.
Yeah, I don't know what to do at the end of podcasts anymore. Like, what social medias am I supposed to be promoting anymore? The ones that I've signed up to in some sheer desperation, just in case Twitter crumbles around beneath me. I don't know. This, by the time this airs, who knows? This could be really dated or kind of really prescient for how things are going. We don't really know at the moment.
He'll have bought Mastodon and ruined it by then as well.
Oh yeah. I've had a go on Mastodon, and I feel like I looked at creating a server and I watched a YouTube video that involved writing code, and I was like, you know what?
It's too much
work. I'm out. You need a whole team for this. Well, before we talk about the House Bunny today, Dave, I wanted to know how you became aware of the Coppola family. So what was your entry point? And then when did you kind of realize, like a sorority house, there's loads of pledges. There's kind of pledges coming in left, right and center throughout the family, as it were. There's a loose metaphor to relate to this film. What was your entry point to the Coppola family?
What would the Coppola house family, sorority house be called? The Coppa Zeta Badas, Francie Coppas,
the Francie 40 Coppas, yeah, maybe, yeah,
the 40 Coppas, yeah. My first entry point was a really boring answer, but it is The Godfather. At age 15, I reckon I was. Where was I? Yeah, so it was around 2000, around the turn of the millennium, Y2K. And, you know, DVDs were becoming a big thing. And I said to my parents, I was about, 15, 16. And I was like, can you get me one of these new DVD players, please? Because I wanted to obviously put on The Matrix, right?
Yeah.
Because, that's the first one we all bought. And then, you know, then the compulsion began as a budding sort of, fancied myself a bit of a cinephile. So I started to write. Just buying binge box sets and do you remember you used to get like just great big collections of trilogies and series? So I got a lovely Godfather trilogy, and I'd never seen it was on my my shame list until age 16, and then
I don't think
popped
that,
her in.
That's not much of a shame list, right?
It's 16, not too bad.
16's
yeah.
I've got, not I mean, bad.
I'm nearly 40. I've got loads of stuff I still haven't seen. I was just blown away, really, by The Godfather. It's just absolutely drawn into it. It flew by. The characters are so compelling, and the performances, it feels so epic and and grand, and then yet so like small and familial in places. And then, yeah, stuck on number two. I know a lot of people consider that to be like one of those rare, like this better than the original. Mm-hmm. But for me, it wasn't a patch on that first one. It's a very different beast, and it's got a bigger canvas. Mm-hmm. But I mean, like for me, that first Godfather is a complete story, right to that, you know, that door closing at the end. Yeah. Just feels like a perfect closing point for me.
And I'm probably the one person who shouldn't, and I think I've admitted it elsewhere before, but I'm not the biggest fan of the the flashback stuff in number two. Like, it obviously, De Niro's great, it's, and stuff
gets in
like,
the way a bit.
Yeah, and I recently ordered a VHS copy. It's the only way you can watch it. That in the 90s they released a chronological cut of all three movies.
Oh, yeah.
And there's part of me that's like, I know I need to watch it just for the sake of it was released, and it like the part like to crown myself. Do you know what I mean? Doing this podcast, I need to have it in, and it's got deleted scenes added back in or whatever. But I'm like, oh, that's going to be like 45 minutes to an hour maybe of just like, I don't know.
Just right, Bobby D eating fruit and wandering through market. Yeah,
nicking.
People are screaming at us now because I mean they are good. It's a great performance, but yeah, I mean it's a less tight sort of a film for me. So yeah, that I mean, and then yeah, less said about the third's better. But that was my sort of relatively standard entry point to the Coppola family.
When did you realize that those like other members? Was there like a well, yeah, the dominoes start to fall. Like, did you realize? Like, how long ago did you realize Cage was a member of the family, or like Talia Shire? Was that around the same time as watching The Godfather? Because obviously, she's in those movies.
No, I don't. I did not know watching them at the time that the Talia Shire relation. I think when I got into the Rocky films a couple of years later, mm-hmm. and absolutely adore them, I think then I started to dig into the background of that, and then I discovered Talia Shire's, you know, related to Francis, and then I think so that was probably the next one, and then it was Lost in Translation, mm-hmm. right, which I think was such a huge success very Sean Connery there, that really, I think I was at the right age for that again. What year was that? 2001, 2002. Yeah, I was saying, yeah, I'm sort of an angsty teenager, mm-hmm. and sort of I really like, you know, you start to get into sort of a moody, melancholy vibes, mm-hmm. and it was very, very cool, and I'm a huge Ghostbusters fan, and so there's just this like different perspective on Bill Murray was very appealing. And then yeah, so discovering that was when I hadn't naturally heard of Sophia until that movie, and then it was like, well, you know, her surname was a giveaway, and then it was Schwartzman, mm-hmm. was the next one. I Heart Huckabees, again, I was a big fan of sort of quirky existential comedy at the time. I doubt that movie's aged very well.
I recently covered that on the podcast, and I watched it for the first time, and my thinking was I would have loved this at the time, but now I just found it quite irksome. It kind of felt like being lectured by an A-level philosophy student.
Okay. Yeah, I could definitely see that, but to it felt absolutely revelatory to me as an 18-year-old.
Yes.
And that's kind of it. And then naturally all you know, they all started to, as you say, fall like dominoes until we got to Matthew Shire, who I just discovered when you invited me on the podcast.
Yeah, he's got a kind of very small IMDb of kind of interesting little tidbits here and there, just like and just all over the place. It kind of and I guess we can touch on nepotism as we go through this episode, because it seems to be a few nepotism babies in this film as well. But Matthew Shire kind of pops up like doing punch up writing on Shrek Forever After, or it's like all types of things, or has worked with the Coppolas on their TV series, Jason and Roman Coppola's TV series Mozart in the Jungle and stuff like that. So he's kind of quite quiet, but quite an interesting little career, I guess. Like, yeah, and he's got a he's got a mini series coming out this year that he was a writer on. So good on Matthew Shire.
Yeah, Kindred.
Yes.
Yeah. So he's got. Yeah, it's hard to sort of pin him down, yes. Really, isn't it? Right, because he's got some writing credits, some sort of producer kind of credits, and then for this, he's a production assistant. And I'll be honest with you, I googled what a production assistant actually does, and this is exactly what Google told me. They are responsible for printing and distributing scripts, running errands for directors and producers, and relaying messages between other members to ensure everything runs smoothly from start to finish. So he was a runner, basically.
Yeah, it can be. Yeah. I think it could be all type of stuff. I've friend of the podcast, Matt Brothers, was I think a runner or like a production assistant on something, and basically on Stardust had to just hold a door closed in the soundstage because it was really noisy when people opened it. So you need to make sure that nobody interrupted Robert De Niro as he's performing a scene, basically, with a creaky door.
Love it.
So have you ever met a Coppola, Dave? I know it's an odd question, but stranger things have happened, right?
I'm afraid not. I would love to.
Yeah. Yeah, well, obviously I would. It's quickly become my life's goal.
That's where it's all leading to, Petros. Right? That's the end game of this podcast.
I think so. Yeah, it's me kind of like stepping into Francis's office and then like, do you know what I mean, being sat down like the end of The Godfather and kind of like,
yeah.
I'm there turning to my family like, don't ask me about my business as the fanfare plays. I guess that's where I'd like to be. I think I know the answer to this question, and it's not going to be that long ago, but or it may be this film exactly. What would have been the first film you would have seen that Matthew Shire had something to do with?
It's probably this film, The House Bunny. I think I might have seen Shrek Forever After. Oh no! Hang on, Airheads. I think I saw Airheads. He was additional crew. He was contributed a lot as the additional crew on Airheads. That's probably it.
A film that has another Coppola connection. So John Schwartzman, Jason, and Robert's older brother was the DOP on that film. So I imagine it would have been like, Talia would have been like, can you get Matt a job as well? Can Matt come along?
Your little brother.
Yeah.
Mom.
He'll just make the tea. He'll be fine. Just give him something. It's kind of perfect as well, because it's looped back to Adam Sandler. So, and obviously he is a producer on The House Bunny, our kind of main event tonight. So let's talk about that. But before we do, here's the trailer.
Being centerfold is the highest honor there is. It says, I'm naked in the middle of a magazine.
Do it.
Hi, Hef. Hi, girl.
Hi, Shelly. Looking good.
Shelly was living the dream until she did the one thing a bunny should never do. She got old.
But I'm 27.
But that's 59 in bunny years.
What's wrong, baby? Okay? You sad? Sad monkey?
I'm gonna need you to low on this.
I guess. I was just doing what he said. Looks like a mini Playboy mansion.
Now.
This is a school?
This bunny is going to teach these girls.
Everyone thinks we're losers.
I'm a bunny. Men write to me from prison.
The tricks of her trade.
They really want to help you guys because I know I can do it.
Shelly, where's your robe?
I'm just walking around in the body God and Dr. Borkman gave me.
This here is Harmony.
Harmony.
What is that? This thing I do to remember people's names.
Natalie.
Wow, you hired the exorcist. Listen.
She'll clean up their act.
The eyes are the nipples of the face.
And turn this house.
I can make you
the hottest girls on campus.
Upside down.
Are you okay?
These glasses don't make me dizzy or anything.
Sweet balls!
We are gonna have the most rockin'est party.
Sometimes helping your friends,
together we can do anything,
is the best way to help yourself.
Give me some of that. Mm-hmm. Oh,
yeah. Why are they acting like that?
Boys just being boys. Thank goodness.
Anna Faris is the House Bunny.
I think I dropped some money over here.
Ah! And it's freaking hot!
So this film was made on a budget of $25 million and had a box office return of $70.4 million and was released August 22nd, 2008. Dave, would you do us the ultimate pleasure of telling us what the House Bunny is all about?
So Anna Faris plays, what's her name here? Shelley Darlingson, who is a Playboy bunny. Who is kicked out of the Playboy mansion due to a series of comedic grievous errors and then finds her way to a local university or a college, as they say in America, and becomes a house mother, which I didn't know was a thing until this movie. So I learned something from the House Bunny. So apparently sorority houses have a house mother who is an older female who sort of helps them. I don't know. I'm still unclear as to the duties of the house mother. What do they do? They sort of help. They're mentor sort of figures, aren't they? And they help them drive pledges and things.
I guess, like, for a lot of teen college dramas and stuff like that, they leave out that kind of clerical role from them, because normally, like, they show it just to be raucous and fun, and like to add in somebody who's like, I actually look after the accounts and like make sure the shopping's done. Like
and also I'm significantly older than all of you.
Yeah.
It would just be a bit odd. So she becomes and then she sort of I think the plot is basically you know, she helps this sorority. It becomes a very classic college movie. Then they're sort of down and out sorority house that's about to lose their funding, and she helps them find themselves and turn the house around, you know, that kind of thing.
So one of the things I find, like, I thought was quite interesting about this film is the fact that the writers of this film, as I mentioned earlier, Karen McCullough-Lutz and Kirsten Smith, kind of
good pedigree, these two.
Yes, that's something I wanted to kind of touch on quite early, and it kind of, I wanted to pose the question quite early as well, like, do you think that this has been happy Madisonified in a way? Because if you kind of look at their
yes,
their other
I do. Yeah, no, you're dead right, because these two, Karen and Kristen, are responsible for. It's funny because we were watching this. I was watching this with Kathy, my wife, and it was the first watch for both of us. And I said to her, "This is trying to be Legally Blonde. That's what it felt like. Mm-hmm. It was trying to replicate for me." And these two, Karen and Kirsten, wrote Legally Blonde, mm-hmm. Or they adapted it for the screen. And they are also responsible for 10 Things I Hate About You. So two very good and successful rom-coms in a similar vein to this. And this does feel like it's in their shadow massively. And I think you're right, Petros. Either there's been some interference from the grown-ups 2 camp to sort of broaden it out a bit, or take, you know, what's the opposite of smoothing out the edges?
just
making the edges a bit rougher,
just putting in a load of Adam Sandler's mates as well, just kind of in like bit part roles and stuff like that, like Nick Swardson. You know, you're in for a bad time when he turns up in a film.
I know, right? And I think the other thing I suspected was that those two successful movies, Legally Blonde, 10 Things I Hate About You, both sort of adaptations are based on some source material, and then sort of punched up. Whereas this is an original pitch. This was an idea that they came up with and pitched to Adam Sandler.
It was originally like pitched by Anna Faris to them, who had this kind of, which sounds like a lot more like a hard-hitting movie, because her initial pitch was a story that revolved around a Playboy model, like, returning to the Midwest and falling into drugs, which would have been like a massive departure for Anna Faris at that time, who I guess for most people would have been famous for the Scary Movie films, right? Like that was kind of where everybody knew her from as Sydney. I can't remember if that's her character's name in that, but like the kind question. Of the Sydney avatar for those movies. And I can't help but think from reading that they've gone to Adam Sandler and his camp, and then there must have been like, well, rewrite it here. Do you know what I mean? Like have a weird animal attack at some point. We've got to have some kind of weird nipple play. Like Shaquille O'Neal's got to pop up for a cameo for some reason.
Yeah, a lot of that stuff just doesn't land, doesn't it? It feels like it needed to. It's like they looked at it and said, "This needs like the comedy set pieces, right?" So we got to have, you know, because I think we're still in the era off the back of American Pie. We're nearly ten years on from that, but I think that movie had such a profound impact on the next 10 years of U.S. comedy that everything had to have a big, gross out, hilarious scene or some sort of, you know, hilarious sort of fish out of water moment. And this movie attempts a few of those. So there's a, you know, there's a scene where Anna Faris has like glammed everyone up and she's given them the makeover and we're past that. And all the girls are looking like, you know, quote unquote, you know, sexy, you know, like conventionally attractive. And then they go to an old folks home and then all their heart rate monitors start going, it's like, oh no. And then there's like, oh, we're going to have a dance scene now. And they're going to dance and all the old people will be dancing. And I feel, and it's just so flat. And I feel like on paper, they must've been like, oh, send them into an old folks home. Hilarity will ensue. But then they didn't really do any of the work to make that funny.
There is a version of that scene as well that is played really tender and sweet. Like there is kind of like,
yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Like there is a kind of, and it's them adjusting to the old folks and like, do you know what I mean? Going in and kind of dancing to the old timey music that they're playing and kind of like, and you would probably have like a good comedic moment from like an old guy, like making some kind of remark like that. There's that guy who's like, I ain't dancing. And then it's like, oh, like, well, we're dancing. He's like, oh, sign me up. Like, he's kind of rubbing his
I'm dancing too. Yeah, I mean, it's just like, I think that's the problem with a lot of the comedy here is just for me, I found it right way too broad. And I think I should say up front, look, I think you teed it up. Like, I didn't enjoy this film. I didn't think it was very good. But the it is, I think, quite beloved. I mean, you know, you and I are in a shared WhatsApp group and we mentioned we were doing this. And all these people came out of the woodwork to defend this movie. And, you know, I was scrolling through the Letterboxd reviews and today, a lot of people really rate it. And I feel like one of the reviews summed it up really well, which was that I love this movie so much, but every time I see it, it gets a little bit worse. And I think it is a movie that has not dated well. And much like we were talking about with I Heart Huckabees earlier, if you saw it at the time, and you're at the right age and the right spot. And this is with so much of, you know, media and entertainment. If it just reaches you at the right point and it connects with you and you're probably a teenager in your early 20s and it is 2008 when, let's face it, things were very different and you could just enjoy this for the light sort of fluff that it is and you can rewatch it a few times on DVD and it becomes a sort of a treasured part of a nostalgic part of your memory or your history and it means something to you, then look, all the better for you and all power to you. But for me, this is not a good movie.
I think to that point of like, yeah, catching this at the time, because 2008, we would have been living in a film landscape pre kind of like broad comedies that were very female centric and kind of like, I don't know, kind of allowed women to be messy. And like, I just think what 2 years later we get Bridesmaids that kind of like really turn the dial on what you could do. And from watching, cause I watched this years ago. I can't really like pin when it was. I don't know why I must've been doing like a Happy Madison watch through like a absolute psychopath that I am.
You masochist.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So I think in the kind of milieu of all of that, it looked it's not a Rob Schneider led vehicle, so it's great. Do you know what I mean? It's not.
Oh yeah, there's worse. This is definitely like mid to top tier Happy Madison. Yeah,
but I think it's almost like such a shame that this wasn't made later. If that script they had kind of kicked about, because you could imagine someone like a Judd Apatow reading this a few years later when he's kind of got the cachet and clout. And either finding like an interesting female director to do it, or someone like Paul Feig, who seems to be like this just amazing like feminist director who seems to like get the best out of like female talent. Like, and watching it again as well reminded me of a film. I'm not sure if you've seen it. I think it's called like Life of the Party. It's Melissa McCarthy film, which is a similar premise where she goes back to college and tries to like becomes the life of the party in like a her daughter's sorority and stuff like that. And I'm like, I was going, is that?
And I say that's a very different film to this, right?
Yeah, but it's not good. It's still not good. It's kind of low rung Melissa McCarthy, you know, and like I think after Bridesmaid she kind of got like slotted into loads of different like comedies, being like, yeah, just do this, do Tammy, do whatever you want, yeah, kind of thing. And that was one of those kind of a bit of a dud one.
See, I think it's really interesting that you mentioned Paul Feig and Bridesmaids, and I think they're two really good references, because, well, it's a kind of one yeah, you know, that's one of the same, but the that was a turning point. You're right, and it's right after this, and that and the wave that followed felt like we were seeing finally kind of real female voices in comedy, right? Because to me, despite the fact that this is written by two women and is starring a range of very talented women, this feels very male gazy. It feels very through the male perspective. Like if you told me that this is was directed by the Farrelly brothers, I wouldn't have been surprised, mm-hmm, right? And it's a shame, really, that my wife, Kathy, couldn't have joined us to provide the female perspective, because I'm very aware that we are two old dudes. talking about 2008, yeah, 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 that was funny. Yeah. But nonetheless, we are where we are. And for me, it felt like the message of the movie was trying to have a very positive message, but not quite landing it, right? Because it does... You know, because am I good to just spoil it?
Yeah.
Who cares, right? I mean, so the movie very much does the, you know, Anna Faris's character comes into this this house full of women who are basically they're outcasts. They're too quirky and individual. They're either intellectuals or they're geeks, or they're, you know, they have braces. Oh my God, mm-hmm, and glasses. And so they just can't fit into this conventional sort of sorority world. They're being bullied. So she Anna Faris's character sort of gives them the glam makeover, and that's all kind of fun. And they become, and then you get that sort of, you know, she's all that moment. They're walking down the street, mm-hmm, hands in hands, and everyone's turning heads and they're like, wow. And they turn the house around and they become this incredibly popular sorority. And this is midway through the movie. So obviously you're waiting for it to come to a point of realization where the movie is like, no, there's more to life than this. And then similarly, Anna Faris's arc is very much, she's trying to have a real relationship with Colin Hanks, mm-hmm, who's not interested in. And I think there's some kind of interesting stuff there, you know, on their date where she's talking about, I did laugh at this, she's just talking about her butt the whole time. And he's just like, uh-huh. And so she's trying to become sort of more interesting on a personality or intellectual level, and they're trying to become more sort of outwardly conventionally attractive. And what the movie then kind of comes to the realization is that they realize, oh, we've become super vacuous and we're judging, mm-hmm, people only on their looks, and that's not how life is supposed to be. We've lost who we are. But then instead of kind of just becoming who they are and becoming individuals, the movie lands on this weird hybrid ending where it's like, we can be ourselves and also be super conventionally attractive. And I guess, and I'm torn on this, is that a positive message? Or is that because they all are just like they look exactly the same as they did?
I think it's
in the middle of the movie, but they like. But also, Emma Stone's not wearing her fucking glasses, and it drives me nuts. Why do people who have prescription glasses suddenly not need them anymore?
Yes,
and they're good looking. That's the other thing. That's the other weird
is the she's all that kind of revelation, isn't it? Take off the glasses, and all of a sudden, like, whoa. Who's that girl?
And I don't need these anymore.
It's kind of interesting to that point of you could see what the film is trying to do. I just don't think it sticks the landing. I guess it's that thing of it's okay to embrace some of those elements of, I don't know, like, conventional attractiveness of kind of, I don't know, I guess. Some people, it's really difficult to say this without sounding like a piece of shit, or do you know what I mean? Trying to word this in a correct way, but I guess it's I'll speak from like personal experience. It's like I've always been, I don't know, looked quite schlubby and stuff like that, but over the last few years, I've started like, I don't know, I recently started going to the gym, and I've like, and it's kind of all of that stuff I would have been dead against, like just the people who do that. Do you know what I mean? It's like that kind of like,
yeah,
oh, I'm not one of these like gym bros and stuff like that. And I don't know, I rail against that. And there's this weird thing in me, like having a skincare routine was like a kind of like, ugh. Do you know what I mean? Not in like a kind of weird masculine thing. I was just like, I don't know. Just
did Mr. Universe move into your house and teach you all these things?
No. Yeah. I don't. What's the difference? Yeah, the Playgirl.
yeah.
I guess instead of a bunny, it'd be a hare, wouldn't it? Moved in to teach. But I think it's that thing of like some people start like, yeah, I started to realize that, oh, some of elements of that aren't as kind of, I guess it's acceptance, right, of both angles. I guess that's where I'm trying to get to. It's the film is trying to go to that thing of, oh, maybe those people, and it doesn't really do it right because there's no like bridges built between the kind of rival factions until the last moment when you kind of get that the kind of underling to Ashley, the kind of leader of the rival sorority, who's like, oh, I'll join up with yours, and it's kind of it's quite throwaway.
But it that bothered me as well, because it's just like, statement means nothing, because she stands up and she's like, I'll join your crew of people who are now exactly the same as our house is. Right. It's just like they modeled their entire house on the conventional sorority house thing, then changed all themselves, then kind of just backpedaled slightly. And then, so it wasn't a huge leap for her. All she did was just choose the more popular house.
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. And like, I guess, I don't know. It's a difficult one to come down on, because maybe I'm giving the film a bit of credit, and obviously really liking the writers. I'm really liking Anna Faris. Like, I do think that she
is great. She's very, very funny.
Yeah. I always feel like, I don't know, something must have happened where she's not been given the career that, or like, do you know what I mean? Like, maybe it is those scary movie films that whenever she went in for auditions or whatever, they kind of said like, oh, we don't need that energy. And she's like, no, I'm trying, like, I can do other stuff, right, guys? And they're like, and that's why she probably, when they pitch it to Happy Madison with this film, they go like, right, we've really got to amp up the what you used to do, Anna. Do you know what I mean? You've come to us with this idea of a film that's about somebody who leaves the Playboy Mansion and kind of goes back to the Midwest and gets hooked on drugs. Let's take all of that away and kind of make this
all the interesting stuff
yeah
away.
Let's make it as broad as possible and kind of,
well, they basically meshed it with this other comedy. They had another script, didn't they, of a sort of a fish out of water house mother, and then they just meshed the two together. And I think that's partly why we, you know, To be fair, I think that as a concept, the movie has a grand concept. Like, I mean, it's fine. That's not the issue. I think it's probably, it just feels a little bit, it doesn't really amount to anything. And I mean, there are better college films, and it feels very conventional as college films go, right? Now, but those beats that you get, those familiar beats are satisfying, right? I mean, I am a sucker for, you know, we've got 2 days to get enough funding to turn our house around and all this kind of stuff. You know, I'm fine with that. But it's just like the movie doesn't, I think the movie's biggest sin for me is that it isn't funny enough. Mm-hmm. I laughed, you know, a couple of times, but the jokes, they throw a lot of jokes at the wall. They're all super broad, not particularly clever. The best line in this movie is the eyes are the nipples of the face, and that made me laugh. That's very good.
There's a line I particularly enjoyed when who is it, Beverly D'Angelo's character says to her, like, this isn't a brothel, and she says, Anna Faris just says, oh no, I'm not here to make soup. I thought that kind of stuff's great, like these kind of like honest mistakes she makes, and like just the kind of like silly wordplay where she can't, I'm going to mispronounce now, she can't pronounce philanthropy. Oh, nailed it. Yes. Like that kind of running joke, or like the stuff she does with her voice. Like I'm kind of enamored by this weird odd deep voice that she does. Like sometimes she there's that running gag, right, that we kind of touched on earlier, where she just says everybody's name in this deep voice. But she just,
that was so good. Do you know what, that really won me over though, because that was so, that's the opposite of broad. That was so weird and like with no real context. It was just like, yeah, oh, this is what I do to remember some people. But it just, every time it kept coming back, it was funnier. So yeah, the movies can be funny, but then most of the time it's like, you know, she goes on the date and dresses as the intellectual, and she's like, again, wearing someone else's glasses, because people who wear glasses are intelligent, obviously. And then is like tripping over tables and getting bubblegum stuck in her hair. And, you know, none of that I thought was particularly well done or interesting. Right. It's all just a bit. Yeah.
And there's some really dated jokes in this film as well for when it came out. There's a Forrest Gump gag in the middle of this film, which kind of feels out like really out of place
14 years after Forrest Gump came out.
Really
lame and not funny. Like, I mean, how many times had that been parodied at that stage? There's some really offensive, I thought a couple of really offensive like jokes, and I'm okay with like teetering on the edge of you know, like I'm comfortable with sort of South Park you know, pushing the boundaries of comedy, and you either laugh at everything or nothing. But there's just a very, I don't know, there's a casual date rape joke at the beginning of this movie, which really I like raised my eyebrows at, because it felt like it wasn't very clever, and it was kind of just making light of it. Do you know what I mean?
And on the,
like, oh yes, I've been date raped several times, basically, or I've been, people have put stuff in my drink all the time, and I'm usually not aware of it. Thank you for telling me. I was like, Jesus Christ.
And this is, in the UK, this is a 12. This is rated, and it kind of, that felt weird. It's kind of, have the edges been like ironed? I don't know. It feels like edges have been added on, but like they've also been, they wanted to keep that, what, PG-13, I guess it would have been in the States, rating. But at the same time, wanted to push it to like an R rating. It kind of, the whole thing for me feels like it's kind of stuck between a pillar and a post in a weird way of like, you can, if you squint, you can see the kind of makings of other interesting movies in there. And I think ultimately what that does for me a lot of the time is go, like, my head starts going, oh yeah, they could have pulled on that thread, and they could have done this, and that would have been really interesting. And like, I guess giving the writers and knowing their work as well, like 10 Things I Hate About You is like fantastic. Really stands up to this day as well. It's just like,
it's brilliant.
Ultimately fun. Like Legally Blonde, for my shame, have not seen, but I know that's got like, that still holds like a lot of weight with people. And I believe that they're writing the script. It's in pre-production for the third film of that as well. So,
oh, right.
So obviously it's got the like going power that like it's coming back as well. And from what I know,
yeah,
of that,
there's
quite a feminist text as well.
There's talent. There's so much talent involved in this movie. And I think that's why it's so frustrating, is because it just all feels squandered. I mean, the writers have cred. Anna Faris is funny. Emma Stone is fantastic in this movie. Colin Hanks is kind of just being nice and charming. Kat Dennings is great. You know, there's a great ensemble cast. You've got great writers. So it just feels like, and a strong premise. So I just feel like this should have been much, much better than it was. It just feels like it was phoned in.
I think the problem they have is that they had the director of Strange Wilderness, a kind of,
yeah,
which is,
I have not seen that, to be fair,
which is, yeah, which is bad, which is real bad. Like that is a real stinker kind of, like mockumentary, just going for like dick and fart jokes constantly, yeah. that has aged probably far worse than this. And he directed them in the same year as well, so it gets like, something to me feels like his heart wasn't in it with this. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's kind of like, I gotta
agree with you. I think a lot of this does lay at the director's feet, unfortunately. So sorry, Mr. Fred Wolf.
Yeah, and I guess there's elements of it that we won't know, the kind of the production rewrites that they would have had to have undergo and stuff like that. And I guess, I don't know.
Not until you get Matthew Shire on the podcast.
Yeah, try
just really dig into it.
try and get Karen and Kirsten on to discuss this film very briefly, and then praise them for their work on 10 Things I Hate About You. I'm just going to have a brief little look over my discussion points here. Yeah, you mentioned the cast, and we obviously, I mentioned it earlier about kind of something I found interesting. I guess I've kind of developed this nepotism radar. Is obviously we have Colin Hanks in this, like Matthew Shire is obviously behind the scenes. He's arguably a nepotism baby. Well, definitely is. And then we have Rumor Williams. We have Bruce Willis's, Rumor Willis. We have Bruce Willis's daughter as Joanne in this film. I always find that interesting. And what did you think of the gang of girls in this film as a whole?
I thought all the performances were very good. I thought none of them really have a lot to work with. They're all very, you know, broadly written. They're all just types. You mm-hmm. know, you've got the nerdy girl, the sort of the weird girl, the goth girl, you know, then they all just kind of become the same, literally the same. That's the plot. They become homogenized by Anna Faris. So then it kind of, they become less interesting. I thought one interesting point to me that I observed was that the one black character in this whole movie is mute. The character is mute, which is not a good look.
Until the final act, right? It kind of, and it plays into that, like almost like that stereotype of like the magical of, do you know what I mean, the magical black person in a film, which is like a kind of like very dodgy trope that has kind of been wheeled out, and this kind of thing of like she is. Even in this group of other, she is like, she is almost singled out as an other as well. Do you know what I mean? In that she doesn't talk.
Yes, because gasp, she's British.
Yeah, 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 yeah. And it's like, okay.
I was like, it's a fine gag on paper, but it was just like, it didn't really land. Bless Kylie Williams did not have a good British accent.
No. There is a moment in this film of all things to think about, and it maybe is because I'm a massive Brian De Palma fan. I couldn't help but think of the prom scene in Carrie when she goes to deliver the the acceptance letters for all of their pledges.
Oh yeah, it is like that.
And there's that kind of deception of like intercepting the letters, putting them in the bin and then putting theirs in. And I was like, that like you could see that in, like, do you know what I mean? In the script, like that would have been like I would like to think they're like, oh yeah, it'd be like a good little carry moment. But then like, I don't know, it just kind of, when you're at that point, it's like, oh, we've got like 10, 15 minutes left of the movie. Do you know what I mean? It's
yeah, and like, now you're engineering some plot contrivance.
Yeah, And then, Anna Faris decides to leave maybe like 25 minutes before the end of the film. Like, it's kind of setting up this big tension of her. Oh, and we haven't even got into the fact that she wasn't kicked out of the, like, the trailer suggests she's kicked out because she's old. Like, the film kind of doubles back on that and kind of says, like, oh, no, it's because there's a rival play button. And it's kind of, there's too many balls in the air, isn't there?
Because Hugh Hefner would never do that, because Hugh Hefner, according to this movie, is just a really nice, loving guy. He's very, very sentimental, you know, just sits around moping, eating ice cream because his best girl has left, and you know he won't attend to the other bunnies, and he's really heart stricken, and it's all just a big bit of confusion. But I think there's been a lot. I think there was a really good podcast series Kathy was telling me about recently on the inside of the actual insides of the Playboy Mansion, through the perspective of an ex bunny, and it is anything but the sort of rosy, glamorous picture that was presented around this era, because this is the same era of the that reality show, right? What was it called, the Inside the Playboy Mansion or something, or Bunnies of the whatever it was called.
I would have been probably prime age for that. I would have been 18 when this film came out, so I must have missed it, Dave, or I'm playing my cards close to my chest. You'll never know. Yeah, and I was a bit suckered and probably a bit of a fool to think at the beginning. I was like, maybe this film's going to be like a damning indictment on the Playboy Mansion. And then I was like, oh no, it's got the involvement from Hugh Hefner and real Playboy bunnies. Of course they're going to come off in great light. Like, what a fool I was at the beginning of this, going like, oh yeah, fuck the Playboy Mansion. Like, they are ageist and...
Maybe in Anna Faris's drug-addled original script, it could have been a bit different.
Yeah, we could have had, I don't know, who would have been a good surrogate for Hugh Hefner as an actor. I'm trying to think.
What they could have done is like done it like just created a separate brand, not call it the Playboy Mansion, but just, you know, and then as you say, just make another character, and then you can be critical of the thing by, you know, making an analog for it. I was just reminded of a similar film from a few years ago. Did you ever see The Girl Next Door with Emile Hirsch and Elijah Cuthbert? It's kind of got a relatively similar premise in that it's a former porn star who moves into a neighborhood and then they kind of strikes up a relationship with this young man. But that to me had a lot more about it.
Yeah.
And I haven't seen this in many years than this movie, but feels like a sort of a similar premise of somebody with, you know, and I think it was more willing to lean into the sort of the society's attitude towards sex workers, or I don't know if the Playboy bunnies could even be considered sex workers, but you know, that sort of, you know, sex as entertainment. And that it kind of had more to say about it, whereas this movie has nothing to say about that, except that Playboy bunnies are, you know, naturally adored by everyone.
Yeah, I'm not sure where the film kind of comes down upon anything. Like,
it's got nothing to say.
Yeah, are we supposed to, like, I don't know, like, because obviously there's great films where, like, there's terrible characters, there's terrible people, but they're still entertaining characters. And like the film itself is kind of going, I don't know, like The Wolf of Wall Street. You watch that film and go like, this is entertaining. Like, or however you feel about that film, it's like, but they are awful people, but there's something entertaining to watch. And the film is very much kind of going like, look at this excess. It's horrible. It's like,
yeah,
there's like, yeah, there's, and I'm gonna,
it's my dad's favorite film for all the wrong reasons.
I'm sure there's many like a London lad like in their business suits who kind of like watch that film and go like, yeah, what an aspirational film.
Exactly.
I guess one of the most pertinent questions I must ask you before we leave this film, Dave, is what do you reckon the production value was on that Aztec party?
I'm so glad you asked me that, because I'd written that down here as well. I wrote down, where did they get the budget for this? Because like one minute they're like, we barely have enough money or pledges to keep this house going. And then they do, I think they do a car wash and then they do a calendar, yes, right? So I guess we are to believe that the proceeds of this calendar have been able to fund what I can only describe as like, as better than Woodstock 99, right? This had, it had like, in terms of organization, in terms of like, it had like a volcano, like they had a volcano that was a slide. Yeah. You know, they had an incredibly well decorated costumes, like full bar, everything. Like I've worked in some event management stuff tangentially. That stuff creates, that's teams of people, yes, and like tens of thousands of pounds of budgets often. Like, so yeah, absolutely farcical.
Yeah, there was that moment I was like, oh, this is where a lot of the budget of this film has gone, like
yeah.
And I think this film as well, I think it rivals Rocky IV for like montages as well. There are certain scenes where it kind of like, I think it goes from like them being made over and then them doing their kind of like coming out walk arm in arm straight into calendar montage. And it kind of like the film yeah, very much plays in like a, let's have a little bit of exposition, like do a couple of plot points, let's get back to the next montage. It's like, now it's Shelley learning stuff montage, now it's kind of
oh yeah,
Shelley not having a good time as a Playboy bunny montage. Like, it's kind of just peppered with all these kind of, yeah, like montage throughout.
But actually, there's another failing of the movie, is that montages can be super funny. You can pack in so many quick visual gags into a montage. And this movie really didn't do the groundwork there either. Because Shirley learning, you know, montage. That montage really, from memory, just contained her sitting in lectures, reading a lot of books, you know, reading more books. It's just like, you just did the bare minimum amount of work here, guys. You've just like, make some fucking jokes, please.
And it doesn't even, when they do the calendar one as well, it doesn't even play into the kind of archetypes and stereotypes they're playing with the different women as well. Like, you just see one of the girls like doing her, do you know what I mean? Like Miss October, yeah, I'm assuming, because like, are you a good witch or are you a bad witch? And there's like, yeah, there's a great like throwaway line there. It's like, the house that's gonna fall on you is gonna be really sexy. Like, it's just like,
yeah, that was funny.
And there's something, I think Emma Stone like is just all, especially around this era, just really charming. And I guess she doesn't get to do it so much anymore, but plays goofy and kind of like awkward really well. And in this, yeah, she kind of,
very much so,
she does it. And there's that moment again in that calendar montage where she's like, she starts, she says that she's like, you're a tiger, baby. And she's like, oh, I saw that in Austin Powers 2. And it's like, just, it doesn't feel like a hollow reference, like the kind of Forrest Gump one. It kind of, it feels honest from that character, that in that moment you would try and say something to G someone up and make them feel sexy, and like your kind of reference point is like all you've got is a film, and it's like, no, this isn't me at all. I've kind of had to borrow this kind of rhetoric from, yeah, something I've seen, as opposed to like, yeah, what I'm doing. And yeah, her throughout the film, I think, like, you just go, you kind of see it, and like, especially looking at it from when it came out, 2008, you go, like, oh, you're gonna be great. Like, this is just a kind of, this is a stumbling block on your way to
Yeah, it's all there, isn't it? Yeah. Like the talent's on display. But you're right about what you said earlier. It is a shame that Anna Faris has not been more, didn't get more of a career, and hasn't been more tested in roles, right? Because we never see a lot of range from her. I don't think she's massively had the opportunity to display her range. And I haven't seen all her movies, but I do feel like she does one type of character, this sort of, and it is similar in Scary Movie, this sort of, you know, ditzy,
yeah,
you know, airhead type. She does that incredibly well. But I would have liked, you know, I would have liked to see a different sort of performance from her.
Well, I haven't had chance to watch it. Funnily enough, this morning I saw, I think it was like the AV Club or something. It's like an interview. She's starring in a film that's, I guess being released now, but it's called The Estate, which stars Toni Collette, Kathleen Turner, David Duchovny. Like, and looks really great. Like, hopefully it's a comedy, but it says here, yeah, the synopsis for it. Two sisters attempt to win their terminally ill, difficult to please aunt in hopes of becoming the beneficiaries of her wealthy estate, only to find the rest of their greedy family members have the same idea. So kind of...
That sounds fun. Good cast.
Yeah. Like, and there's Ron Livingston's in there as well. So like, that sounds like a lot of fun, right? And it's kind of, hopefully, and I know she's shined up elsewhere. Like, she's got an amazingly successful podcast, and I've listened to a few episodes in the past. And
yeah.
She is somebody.
She's very charming.
You root for, right?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah, 100%.
I think that's why I'm going to say it. That's why everyone hates Chris Pratt. It's like, how can you leave Anna Faris?
It's part of the reason. Yeah, she's definitely she's the of the two of them. She's the one you root for sure.
Yeah, if you're in a custody hearing and you're getting, like, do you know what I mean? If you're given that opportunity, you know, like they do in TV and films all the time. If you're a dog and you're given
choose
that,
one parent.
Yeah, yeah, choose which one you want to go to. It's like, I'm going to Anna Faris any day of the week, like.
Every time. but then Chris Pratt would do the Jurassic Park move on you, and you'd he'd put his hand out,
and then
you'd be so subdued. You'd end up following him.
But then anyone could do that.
The man's got powers.
Anna Faris could do that, as we learned in Jurassic Park Dominion. Anyone could do that. You don't have to build up a intrinsic link with one dinosaur over a long time. You can just do it to any dinosaur, and it doesn't matter who you are. Well, Dave, is there any other points that we've missed on this film before we kind of put the house bunny to bed?
I don't think so, although I love the phrase put the house bunny to bed. It feels very tangential to bring it back to the very, very original start of your podcast to Nicolas Cage in Con Air, right?
Yeah.
Put the house bunny to bed.
Put the house bunny back in the box. That's what I should have said. Fuck, fake Dave.
Oh, so close.
Oh, damn. If only we had the Happy Madison writing team here, we could have got there instead. I guess like the end of this film is kind of in, like, I don't know, it's kind of it pans out how you think it's got. There's some last act kind of contrivances, and there's a bit of tension with the, you need 30 names, 29 put their hand up and stuff like that. And then there's the...
I mean, it all plays out exactly as you expect. Yeah.
You got Shooter McGavin like...
Oh, yeah, always welcome. I'd say I'm okay with a movie that plays out exactly as expected. It just felt like they were doing that and kind of just phoning it in a bit.
Mm-hmm.
Right, I feel like, and I mean the kind of production and the set pieces here, because I think the actors are all kind of doing their best with very little.
Yeah. I think it very much, like, from a point of like Anna Faris, it feels like, well, if you want this movie made, this is how it's got to get made. Like, do you come on the ride, or does your film not get made? And I guess that's the kind of eternal struggle with filmmaking a lot of the time anyway. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's like,
It's all compromise.
Yes. Yeah. Exactly. As we kind of put this film, put the bunny back in the box. Let's finally get that gag in. Let's ignore the fact that we had that whole bit earlier. What we do all the time on this podcast, Dave, is we look for Coppola connections within the film. So is anyone who worked on this film, either in front of or behind the camera, worked with the Coppola family elsewhere in their filmography at all?
I don't know, Petros. I didn't do my research on this bit.
Don't worry, I've only got.
Yeah, I'm sure you're lined it up.
I've got three here. Just some quick ones. I've got Anna Faris is actually in Lost in Translation, which is directed by Sofia Coppola.
Is she?
Yeah, she. I think she from recollection. I haven't watched it in a few years. I'm kind of holding out to rewatch that for when I cover it on the podcast. But from what I remember, she's the person who Giovanni Ribisi is like cheating on or like kind of flirting with.
Yes. Yeah. All right. Nice. I didn't put that together.
And Emma Stone is in The Amazing Spider-Man, which John Schwartzman was the cinematographer on, and is in The Croods 1 and 2, which obviously Nicolas Cage does the voice of Grug. And Beverly D'Angelo is in the film Dreamland, which stars Jason Schwartzman and is directed by his younger brother, Robert Schwartzman. So a nice little double Coppola connection there. So, Dave,
there you go.
Let's rate this film. And the way that we do that here is we think of the perfect wine pairing for this film. The Coppolas love their wine. Francis Ford Coppola is paying for a film off the sale of his bloody vineyard. What a guy. So what would be the perfect wine pairing for the house bunny, Dave?
I think this would go well with a nice glass of Lambrini.
Oh.
Or like an Echo Falls, you know, rosé.
Mm-hmm.
We're talking sort of, you know, €4.50.
Yeah. Lambrini rosé,
Mid-shelf in Asda, yeah.
Yeah, you want something like. And you want one of those promotional bottles as well that's kind of in that weird plastic wrap, like, and it's kind of really garish and pink. Yeah.
Yeah, the more garish, the better. You want something like, it's sickly sweet and it's very artificial. But there is a hint of a grape in there somewhere.
Yeah, something you'd be vomiting up in a park, like, during your teenage years. Yeah. That feels perfect.
You want to get ID'd buying this, basically.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you want to have pestered an older sibling or somebody down the shops to get it for you, or kind of like begged your mum, or but like you got that weak-willed parent in the friend group.
Come on, mum, I'm watching the 2008's The House Bunny.
We just want to have fun. Come on. that, or if we go off of the wine, I think, this has got Alco Pops written all over it.
For sure.
So, Dave, how much are we paying for this wine? Is it bottom shelf, middle shelf, or top shelf?
Oh, it's bottom shelf, man, all the way for me.
Okay. I guess, I don't know. I had a few involuntary laughs throughout this film. So I hesitantly put it on the bottom shelf, but like that, my head saying bottom, my heart saying middle, like, and I'm talking like the lowest,
go with your heart, Petra.
Yeah. It's the lowest,
put it on the middle.
It's the lowest shelf on that middle section. Right. I'm still,
it's in the special offer section. Yes. It's got a yellow tag.
It's got a yellow tag. It's got a yellow tag. If this were a restaurant wine, we're staying on the first page. We're not turning over that page, Dave. No. So based on this film alone, I must ask you, are the Coppolas the greatest film family of all time?
Based on this film? Clearly. Their influence. that's partly why I picked this film, because it was just funny to me that we went from the Godfather to this. there is a tangential connection.
There is there is a whole swath of films and family members I haven't covered, because a lot of the time people are like, I don't even know what that is. And I found the fact, like, I can't even, like, I'm not sure if I'd know how to watch that here. Like, it's kind of like do a tertiary, like, just watch, and it's like basically get a shrug emoji.
Question mark.
So we're going with a yes on that. So, yeah, Matthew Shire doesn't bring shame to the Coppola family.
No, he held the creaky door open and kept the noise down on set very effectively. I didn't hear a single bit of noise. So production assistant, big tick.
Perfect. Well, before I let you go, I must ask you a couple more questions. The first being, which Coppola family member would you keep, but in doing so, you get rid of the entire filmographies of the rest of the family?
That's a good question. I think I'm just a sucker for Jason Schwartzman, I gotta say, because I get to keep a lot of the Wes Anderson.
Mm-hmm. Pretty much stuff. All of them, bar two.
Yeah. So yeah, he's my answer.
And I think I figured out he's got like the most screen time of all of the Coppolas, just because he's done so much TV work as well. He's done like multiple series of.
Yes. Bored to Death was a good show that didn't get any love.
Yeah.
That featured white wine quite heavily.
Yeah, well, that will soon be covered on this here podcast at some point. We'll be doing a deep dive into Bored to Death. And I think a season of Fargo as well he's in. So, yeah, I think he's...
Is he?
Yeah. One of the... Because it's like an anthology show now, isn't it? So, like, he plays like some kind of mobster in one of season three or something. Oh,
fantastic.
Like that. So, you get a lot of Schwartzman for your buck, because that's a perfect choice, Dave. I must ask you though the most important question of this podcast, which is, what does Notorious Put Seth Green in a Bin Bill Murray say to Scott Johansson at the end of Lost in Translation?
I think now, I mentioned Ghostbusters earlier. I'm going to bring it back to that. I think, and considering he's so again, Ghostbusters or more Ghostbusters, I think he probably said to her, "Bustin' does not make me feel good." Maybe something like that.
They duped me.
Like a confession. There's a confession sort of vibe to it, isn't there?
Yeah. They duped me to come back for the sequel. They told me it was another movie.
Shouldn't have done that sequel.
Amazing. Well, on that note, Dave, where can people find you and the Fantastic Cinemile podcast?
Well, we're if you search the Cinemile, that's Cinemile, and we're at the Cinemile on Elon Musk's platform of choice, or Letterboxd, or. Wherever you get your podcasts, but it's such a cliche now, you know, but
it's a catch-all. It works.
It works.
For a reason.
We're on all the podcast things.
Yeah. You can just whisper into the air. And if you wander around long enough, you'll see.
And I'll whisper back.
Yeah, you'll see Dave and Kathy wandering the streets at some point. You can listen to it live. Amazing. Well, Dave, thank you so much for coming and making some Coppola connections with me.
Thanks, Petros.
And there we have it. Episode 55 is in the bank, and we have another check mark for the Coppola family. Another vote for yes. Was that a vote for yes? I believe Dave voted for yes. If I got that wrong, let me know. Another massive thank you to Dave for joining me for this. It was an absolute joy to discuss this film. I know he didn't enjoy it as much as I did, but it's always fun to have these conversations irregardless. And a massive thanks for you guys for listening. It's always an absolute joy. If you enjoy this film, if you like The House Bunny, if you agree with us, if you disagree with us, please don't hesitate to get in touch. You can do so by heading over to all of the socials, wherever they may be, which are Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, Letterboxd, and TikTok, all at Caged In Pod. Who knows? I might be on some other socials, or maybe I'll drop the... Yeah. You know the drill, guys. Twitter's up in flames, so I might be. I don't know. Am I gonna go jump ship? Hell no. I'm gonna be there till the bitter end. I'm gonna be clinging onto a door and hoping that there's enough room for two of us. Well, it's only me, so fuck Jack. I'm rosing this bitch, and I'm clinging onto that door, and I'm going down with the Titanic, baby. So if those of you might be listening to it in the future or just live under a rock, yeah, Twitter's kind of imploding in on itself, but who knows? It's been fun. It's been a great ride. I've recently said to somebody that maybe this podcast doesn't exist without Twitter, at least with the plethora of amazing guests. Hey, for instance, I probably wouldn't have spoke to Dave today if I didn't have Twitter. So look at that. It's evil, it's a hell site at times, but it's also been an absolute boon for this podcast. And yeah, as I said, booking guests and getting to speak to people that I really admire and enjoy their work. And filmmakers, everyone. Yeah, just the opportunities I've had through that website is insane. Well, enough of that. If you want to drop me an email, which is something that is sturdy and will not be going anywhere anytime soon, you can do so, which is cagedinpod@gmail.com. Something else that won't be going anytime soon, and if you want to support this podcast financially, you can head on over to patreon.com/cagedinpod. Yeah, just give me who knows of exchange rates right now? Give me 50p a month to help me keep the lights on here. Or a little bit more if you fancy it. Who knows? So you can head on over to Patreon. And there's some great stuff behind that paywall. And there will be more soon. There's the Movie Brat Bros series. There are some bonus stuff from a lot of the Cage episodes. There's some other fun little stuff behind there. However, if you do not wish to part with any money, and I totally understand that because we are living through difficult times financially, emotionally, politically, all kind of illies. It's difficult out there, so I totally get it. You can head on over to Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you're listening to this right now. Rate, review, and always let me know in your reviews what you think Bill Murray says to Scarlett Johansson at the end of Lost in Translation. Who knows? The recent allegations about Bill Murray. Am I going to have to change that question? Is that going to age like milk? Is that going to age like a banana? And people are going to be like, oh, you've been asking that question for so long. And it should be, I'm sorry for my appalling actions to people. But still leave a 5-star rating and review, regardless of that maybe now terrible question. So, guys, as ever, I've been Petros Patsilivas, your guide through the crazy world of the Coppola family tree. Remember to keep it caged in, and I'll catch you next time.
This podcast is presented by the Breadcrumbs Collective, home of the Pod Charles Cinecast, Caged In Coppola Connections, A Drooptown Limerick, Maine, Franchised, and many more to come. Our shows are all presented ad-free and made possible by listeners like you. Please support our shows by subscribing, leaving ratings and reviews, and becoming patrons at patreon.com. If you'd like to learn more about Breadcrumbs, head over to breadcrumbscollective.com.
Breadcrumbs. It's more than a podcast network. It's family.